Hi, I'm Christopher Rufo.
And I'm Jonathan Kieperman. You probably know me as Lomez.
We live in a time where the institutions have been captured by ideology that's fundamentally contradictory to the American way of being and really for even understanding the world that we live in.
What we do isn't just commentary. It's analysis. Cultural, historical, philosophical. We zoom out. We connect the dots. We ask the questions that legacy media is either too afraid or too incurious to touch.
So if you want to understand what's happening and why it's happening, it's time to tune in to the Rufo and Lomez show. It's something that you don't want to miss.
Please subscribe. We'll keep you up to speed on everything that's going on. We'll keep you centered down the middle of the line so you can see the road ahead of you and know the best way to move forward. It's the Rufo and Lomez show. Please subscribe now.
Stu Does America.
Subscribe on YouTube, youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. I'd appreciate it if you did that. Wendy Sachs is here to preview her. Actually, it's actually already out, right? You can rent it now. It's a great documentary on the fallout from October 7th. It's just the stuff that they have is insane. You have to check this thing out. We'll talk to her in a second. We also have a brand new pope. I don't think it's Jeffy. I don't think he won, although it's an American pope. When I heard American pope picked, I thought it might have been Jeffy, but no. We'll go over the latest from Vatican City on that, though. We're going to start, though, by doing the UK trade deal. A big announcement today from President Trump announcing a trade pact with the United Kingdom. That is the first of his announcements, you know, as far as these coming deals that we'd be expecting. And honestly, like, I don't know that we know all that much about it yet. It was kind of an announcement of a framework of an announcement, which is coming here in the next few weeks, where they're going to kind of flesh out all the details. Most of it seems to be basically lined out. It's not going to be a huge change as far as like tariff rates or anything like that. It does seem to give us some additional access, some lower tariff rates on automobiles and such. They did do a little fancy graphic for us. Here it is, United Kingdom trade deal. Now, one interesting part about this is we didn't lower the tariffs on them. They're still at 10%. So it wasn't really like anything. I was kind of hoping for a sort of a free market reset with the United Kingdom on both sides. We didn't really get that. What we got was a continuation of the 10% tariffs that are going on with from us to them. The way that the White House is reporting this is the tariffs used to be 5.1% against us, and now they are 1.8%. And on the other side, our tariffs against them used to be 3.4%, and now they are 10%. So it used to be that they had slightly higher tariffs than us, and now we have tariffs about 5+ times higher than what they have on us. That's kind of the outline that they provide. They also they say that we have $5 billion of new market access. Of course, new market access I'm definitely in favor of. Tariff revenue of $6 billion. That one,
I don't know. Maybe I've been around too long. I don't know. That sounds very much like what the left would say. When you say tariff revenue of $6 billion, that's what they say when they increase taxes. That's revenue to the government. Well, what's going to happen is $6 billion or more are going to go to our government in their projections. I wouldn't put that in the bright green logo. I'd probably put that one in the red myself. But, you know, I don't know. It's just my thing. I don't know that it's necessarily this. The overall. Some analysis are already showing that when it comes to trade weighted tariff rates, it's a change of less than a tenth of a percent overall. So I don't know that it's a massive deal, but anything times we can improve our relationship with the UK, I think that's positive. And if we can get access for certain products into the UK, that makes it a little bit easier because the UK was not super free market, honestly, on the other side before this either. That could be positive. I would love to see the tariffs go away. We'll see if that happens. I will say, I apparently am the only one left that doesn't want a lot of tariffs. And look, it might be true. Frankly, I'm fine standing. I really feel uncomfortable when people agree with me. I don't know if you've noticed that watching the show over the years. So I'm fine standing in that world. But I didn't know I was in that world completely. There's a story that came out from the Free Press, which I enjoy. I like the Free Press. The intellectual godfathers of protectionism, kind of looking back in the day, you know, to the Pat Buchanan days and things like that. But this is the part that went viral of the article. No one anymore on the left or the right denies that globalization has fractured the U.S. both economically and socially. It has hollowed out once prosperous regions like the furniture-making areas of North Carolina and the auto manufacturing towns of the Midwest. It has been a driver of income inequality. Gosh, I mean, the words that we, the words and phrases that we're just adopting these days, that's fascinating. Perhaps most alarmingly, the U.S. has outsourced not just the manufacture of toys and furniture, but pharmaceuticals and semiconductors. Definitely worries there. Products we need for our national security. Trump owes much of his political success to the fury that these realities arouse in working class Americans. Now, some of that, I think, is there's a lot of a wide agreement on. I mean, I think, you know, pharmaceuticals and semiconductors, there's definitely worries about how that would happen if in a pinch. You know, you're depending on places like China or, you know, to provide those. Really, the national security concerns are very real. I think that broadly goes across the aisle, but I think the phrasing of it is a little bit too broad, frankly, when it comes to no one disagrees or no one thinks that when they call it globalization, it's kind of they phrase it in that way. But generally speaking, talking about free trade. I don't think that there's no one anymore. I think that there are some. There are dozens of us, literally dozens of us, which raises an obvious question. Why did so many economists, policymakers, and journalists like me, this is the author, saying that he refused to acknowledge the problems with neoliberalism for so long? Why were we so quick to label anyone who even flirted with an idea that maybe the U.S. should be protecting its industrial base, just as other countries did? Why were they painted as a Pat Buchanan-like fool? Now, that is fascinating because it was largely the left-wing media that was calling Pat Buchanan a fool. He had ideas I certainly didn't agree with, but it wasn't conservatives generally who were criticizing him in that way, even though there was he was a part of the conservative spectrum, but I wouldn't say the majority of it. On the left, they were killing him all the time for basically every single thing he said. I wanted to go through, though, some of this because I think the issue is more important than the personalities here. That's a lot of times what happened was, what does Donald Trump say? Is he a bad guy or a good guy today? That's what the media is always trying to sort out. I'm tired of that, frankly. We know what the media thinks, honestly, about Donald Trump. Have we not learned already? I mean, how many times do we have to hear it? I've heard it 7 trillion times. I don't need to hear it anymore. I got it. The media doesn't like the guy. Fine. When it comes to free trade, again, like, is it about this author being wrong? Is it this author being right? I don't think that's necessarily the full scope of the conversation. You know, it is interesting where he came to the conclusion, as Dominic Pino points out. He's got a piece out. There's a trade surplus of poorly reasoned protectionist think pieces. He says, Jonah Serra has written for the Free Press what feels like the 1,000th think piece about how the cold, heartless neoliberals took over all American economic policy in the 1990s and have been proven wrong thanks to Donald Trump. Nasera writes from the perspective of someone who, as a journalist in the 90s, covered free trade as if we've been handed holy scripture. Given that journalists' coverage of religion is reliably awful, it should come as no surprise that their coverage of economics and trade has been as well. What Nocera reveals in the piece is that he came to his views on trade not by studying economic theory or reading economic research. Instead, he was swept up in a wave of media sentiment supporting free trade in the 90s. So it makes perfect sense that he would be swept up in a wave of media sentiment supporting protectionism today. And I think that is one of the things that we do lose in this debate, because you can certainly find, as I've mentioned, multiple places where you could say, OK, well, this is a problem area for the United States when it comes to outsourcing all of our pharmaceutical production or outsourcing a lot of our, you know, issues related to our national defense. You can kind of sit there and say, like, I think a lot of people would widely agree. You can also say, hey, you know, I don't like what we're doing with China. Like, this is an adversary. They can kind of pull the rug on us whenever they want. And I don't know that that should be our main source of everything from pharmaceuticals to, you know, really crappy toys. I don't want to give them any money for anything, frankly, even though they do have a really wide industrial base. And a lot of times we do buy products from China. But like that kind of separates from the reality of the situation. There is this picture. And by the way, this picture was drawn up by largely the left over the years, that the middle class has been hollowed out, that people who were had these great manufacturing jobs, you know, in the of course, they use the same people in the documentaries later on when they complain about our health care because their backs are all broken and they can't function anymore. I don't understand how that works exactly. But the idea that they had the great manufacturing jobs in the Midwest, they were living life in Detroit and Flint, Michigan. And now their lives are all ruined. And this is all because of capitalism and free trade. You know, I just don't think that's the reality of the situation at all. And, you know, I thought maybe we'd go through some of the details on that. Dominic links to a bunch of economic charts in here that show, kind of paint this picture. And I think it's worth going through. If you could look at, you think of the person that is always described, right? You've got this guy who's, you know, maybe he didn't go to college. Maybe he's working on the manufacturing lines because that's the, you know, that's the job he wanted, a blue collar job. And, you know, what happened to those people? Well, we can look at the economic data on those people. Were they really hollowed out? Were they, did they really disappear? Did they really start losing money because of that? Well, we have charts that talk about this. These are people who are employed full-time, median, usual weekly nominal earnings, wage and salary workers, high school graduates with no college, 25 years and older. And as you see, really, like since the mid-90s, we've seen an increase, a pretty significant increase in those wages over time. Now, that looks at kind of the country. And I think there's a reasonable ask here, which is, hey, maybe this did, a lot of people who look at this a little bit more in a more sophisticated way will say, okay, maybe this did benefit the country overall over these periods of time, because we did have obviously lower cost goods. And you know, look, you could sit here and complain about low cost goods. I don't. But when things cost you less, that means you use the rest of that money. We're not exactly savers in this country. You usually spend it on other things, which is usually other businesses, which are usually propping up other employment, right? If you're saving a bunch of money at Walmart, that money usually goes somewhere else. And a lot of times that might be the thing that supports American jobs. Maybe you're spending more on a car that's made in America. Who knows? So the question, though, is does it hollow out these particular communities? The ones mentioned in the article in North Carolina, in Michigan. What actually happens? Well, let's look at the entire country. This is wage growth for every single state, and this is at the real median wage. What you see here is literally, without exception, every single state between 2021 and 2024 had a rise in their inflation-adjusted earnings. Every single one. The smallest one you will see is Michigan, and that is obviously the one that has had the most attention because you had these sort of massive auto manufacturing there, and a lot of that did go away. That is real. That did happen. But it is important to note that even in Michigan, rates, the pay went up, but it went up in every single state in the union in this period. That's significant. We talk about stagnating wages. Those are really decent growth over a long period of time, not year to year, not like cherry picking, but a 20 plus year period. Also, and another criticism is, well, yeah, sure, maybe the average person did better, but what about people on the lower end of the scale? So let's look at that, the lowest 10th, the 10th percentile line. And what you see in, looks pretty similar, actually. Every single state in the union had an increase. And in fact, the increase is larger among the lower income population than even at the middle. And of course, as we all know, the rich always get richer, so they did pretty well as well. Now, if you look at this and you say, okay, well, all the states went up, but what about these communities? And I think that's really where you can actually find evidence of a change. But what is the cause of that change and how significant is the change? The two that they were mentioned in the article were North Carolina and Michigan, Flint, Michigan, and Greensboro in North Carolina. And what you see is at the low end of the income scale, growth was pretty significant in even for Flint, 40% growth, 26% growth in Greensboro. However, at the median line, you do see this. This is that middle class argument, right? In Flint, a 16.3% drop. There was still increase in North Carolina, so that did not play out in North Carolina. But Flint, Michigan is kind of the, I mean, no offense if you're listening in Flint, kind of like the boilerplate, like billboard catastrophe when you're talking about the scenario playing out. And it's true, that really did go poorly. I mean, we know this, right? Like, this is not something that's new. It's not something that came around certainly in the 90s or the 2000s or the 2010s. I mean, you go back to Roger and Me. This is the movie with Michael Moore. His kind of first documentary was about Flint, Michigan and these jobs going away. It was released in 1989. When you look at the manufacturing base of Flint, Michigan, you see a massive drop. The drop started in the 70s. I mean, you know, before Ronald Reagan was even in office, the drop was going on. This was not a Ronald Reagan free trade problem. And when you think about this situation, when you think about what actually happened here, it's important to think about we can kind of like vilify China for all of this. And I'm frankly kind of on board with vilifying the Communist Party of China. Like, I kind of like it. Frankly, I blame them for a lot of stuff. I noticed they killed a few million people with a virus they released recently. There's a lot of problems. They starved, you know, 60 million of their people over the past century. That was bad. I thought that was a negative outcome. So there's lots of stuff to blame China for. And I think you can look at certain manufacturing areas and find that. But of course, we're not getting a lot of our cars produced in China, right? Like, there are a few. The tariffs on those are very, very high, but they really haven't even penetrated our market largely, right? Like, the cars that were made in Flint, Michigan are not being made in China. The cars that were made in Flint, Michigan are being made in places like Mexico, some in Canada, but largely a lot of them are being made in places like South and North Carolina. That's where they went. A lot of it, at least. Those factories, there's a massive employment increases in those areas when it comes to the cars. Now, I will say, just as a guy who hates cold weather, part of that might just be, I can't do another Michigan winter. But the much larger part of that was Democratic-backed unions that destroyed those communities. And of course, Roger and me is the opposite. It's arguing that, actually what we need are more unions. That has not worked out. The places where the jobs have come from auto manufacturing have come from right-to-work states. States that are red, that are in the South. Those have been booming. I mean, they're building basically entire cities in Texas around Tesla manufacturing right now. This manufacturing is happening. It's happening in the United States, but it is not happening in places like Michigan, where Democratic politicians have tried to implement their left-wing ideology around unions for decades and decades and decades. That has largely failed, to be clear. It hasn't worked. And those jobs largely have gone away from those areas, but they've been populated in other areas of the United States with more business-friendly policies. At the end of the day, we can look at this and, you know, tariffs are going to be this argument. And it's really difficult to talk about this with most people because they get, you know, there's a lot of passion on both sides. There's a lot of partisanship, frankly, that, you know, the left is never going to relent on a lot of those policies. But, like, we don't know where this is going to go when it comes with Trump's policies on tariffs. We saw him talking about it as a negotiation. He's making trade deals. We're going to see where those get fleshed out. I mean, even the one he announced today, as I mentioned, isn't really fully fleshed out yet, as he talked about in his press conference today. But, like, the longer term thing here is to understand that I think, you know, these things, while they haven't been perfect, have done a lot of good for the United States, has actually improved life in a lot of ways. And we're going to, if we lose that, and when I say when we lose that, is we're not going to lose it completely. It's not going to disappear. It's going to go to other places. Other places are going to be able to implement the policies that we kind of led the world on. And if we abandon those policies and allow other countries to implement them, we're going to have the wrong side of it. We're going to have the wrong side of that outcome. You know, a tax increase is a tax increase. And I don't root for tax increases, not just because I don't like paying more for stuff. Of course, I don't. But also, when we were talking about economic activity, when thousands and millions of dollars are changing hands, when more of that money goes to the government, I think conservatives inherently know that is not the most effective way to route those dollars. When we're talking about economic activity, we want those to be between two consenting adults and two consenting parties, rather than between a party and through a government, and they take a bunch of it and then they waste it on God knows what, and then that never gets back into the economy. We're the ones that kind of developed that theory. We're the ones that went through all of this to kind of prove that, I think, right over time. Look, you're never going to get an entire agreement. You even go back to the area of maybe peak free trade and you'd say, well, Pat Buchanan still disagreed. And a lot of people now agree with Buchanan more. That's fine. But we should at least understand what we're losing and what we might be gaining. I will say this agreement with Britain doesn't seem to do anything to address bringing manufacturing jobs back here. In fact, we have a trade surplus with Britain anyway. It's just that we have to look at this as a big picture and look, do what we like to do here on this program. We don't do a cost analysis. We don't do a benefit analysis. We do a cost benefit analysis. And when we look at that, we are going to find some areas where these policies may very well work. But on the other hand, we got to make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Who does America?
Ah, well, think about making things just a little spicier in the bedroom. Does that appeal to you? Well, if it does, you're going to want to try Blue Chew, especially Blue Chew Max, which combines the active ingredients of Viagra and Cialis into one chewable tablet. It's fast-acting, it's long-lasting, and now you can get a whole month of it for free. Just sign up at BlueChew.com. You can consult with one of their licensed medical providers, and once you're approved, they're going to give you the prescription within a few days. Blue Chew tablets are made right here in the USA. Don't have to worry about tariffs there. How about that? Prepared, shipped directly right to your door. The best part, it's all done online. That means you don't have to, make any visits to the doctor's office. You don't have to have any awkward conversations with anyone. And you don't have to wait in line at the pharmacy. You make your life a little easier with Blue Chew. Discover your options at BlueChew.com. And they've got a deal going on right now. The first month of Blue Chew is free when you use the promo code STEW. Just pay $5 shipping. The promo code is STEW at BlueChew.com. BlueChew.com for more details and important safety information. Check it out. BlueChew.com. BlueChew. .com.
This is not about Jews. This is about democracy. This is about human decency.
What does it mean that the future leaders of the most important democracy in the world are chanting for Intifada? What is the country going to look like a decade from now?
What is at stake is the soul of America.
Really powerful documentary. I'm joined now by Wendy Sachs, the executive producer and director of October 8th. This is a new documentary out about exploring the rise of anti-Semitism on college campuses. Wendy, thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Stu.
It's a really powerful documentary. I just frankly doesn't seem possible. I lived through these events. I watched these college protests play out. Of course, watched the horrible attempts of events of October 7th. It doesn't feel possible in a modern world, and certainly in the United States, that we could be watching this happen.
I mean, I think so many people were really rattled by October 7th, but it was really the aftermath, October 8th and beyond, that celebration of Hamas as freedom fighters rather than being condemned as terrorists. So we saw in the streets of New York and around the country and on college campuses that I think shook us to our core, people in the Jewish community, but beyond. I mean, I think that this embracing of jihadism and Islamic extremism as somehow the antidote to capitalism is sort of this bizarre phenomenon that we're seeing happening on college campuses, where you're seeing Houthi flags and Hamas flags next to LGBTQ plus flags. I mean, none of this makes sense. It feels like we're in a dystopia. I mean, I think we really are in very strange times. But the rise in the explosion of anti-Semitism on college campuses and on social media and the streets of America is really what this film is about. We're not litigating the war. This isn't political. But this is, how did we get to this moment in America today with this embracing of Hamas as these freedom fighters? That's what this film is all about.
It really is. And it's just stunning. Obviously, you go through all of this, and I want to get into all the detail as you go through the movie. But the title is really interesting to me, and you highlight this right at the beginning. October 8th, it's the day after. This was not 6 months after. It was not after everyone got frustrated at whatever That's Israel right. was doing in Gaza. Right. This was yeah. literally the day after when all of this started.
Yeah, and that's really what this film is about, is that Hamas and SJP on campuses, Students for Justice in Palestine, they were ready to go. This is not an organic student organization like other clubs on campus. This is not Students for Climate Change or Students for Reproductive Freedom or Students for anything else. We're talking about an organization that's aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood and American Muslims for Palestine that can trace their connection back to Hamas. And one of the most revelatory scenes in the film happens at a Marriott hotel room in Philadelphia in 1993, where we show an FBI wiretap, where the FBI is wiretapping a conversation Hamas in America is having about how they're going to infiltrate institutions in America, how they're going to penetrate American universities, and how they're going to get into the media And they're going to speak in terms of, when they're speaking to people on the left, they're going to speak in the language of apartheid and colonialism. And when they're speaking to people on the right, they're going to speak in terms of the of patriotism and the founding fathers. Hamas 30 years ago, by the way, this conversation was recorded in 1993. So 30 years before the October 7th attack, Hamas was already sophisticated and savvy and well-funded and figuring out how they were going to permeate American institutions. So what we see on October 8th is no surprise. There's actually a toolkit, a media toolkit, that SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine chapters across America are using on campuses. They're using the same language coming from Hamas. They're appropriating the same iconography, that upside down red triangle that Hamas uses when they're targeting the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. That upside down red triangle is graffitied on buildings across America, including the Benjamin Franklin statue at the University of Pennsylvania. So what we're seeing on October 8th and beyond is methodical, it's sophisticated. This is not just an organic explosion. This is coordinated. So on October 8th, these students on college campuses are ready to go. We saw it at Harvard with more than 30 student groups signing onto a letter blaming Israel for the attack on itself, as if Israel had it coming. And to your point, Stu, this is well before the Israeli Defense Forces even responded, right? But we're already seeing that hate explode on October 8th.
Yeah, really fascinating. We should point out, too, you're not just reporting on that 1993 tape, that the audio is in the documentary. You can actually hear them in their own words discussing exactly what they're going to do. And it's really a familiar playbook, I think, to anyone who follows this now. It was interesting to see, too, how instantly they adopted the Hamas even language. The attack itself called the Al-Aqsa Flood. And the word flood used in almost every single protest across the country. These are not coincidences.
It's not a coincidence. And I'm so glad that you pointed out that word flood, the Al-Aqsa flood. That was the language used for the attack on Israel that Hamas was using. That's what they categorized and named the attack on Israel when they murdered more than 1,200 and they kidnapped 251 people. That's the language. And that Al-Aqsa, that flood the streets of Palestine, flood, that same language is being appropriated by student groups on college campuses across America. The paraglider images, it's the same language, it's the same imagery, it's the same iconography, and it's all mashed up, and it's living in places where students and young people and the most educated people in America are getting their information. And so I think this propaganda campaign, the social media piece of it, it's so nefarious. And that's also one of these things that we're unpacking in the film is how did we get to this moment where the young people, the smartest people at the most elite and prestigious institutions in our country are somehow being brainwashed by Islamic terrorists. And that, again, those people are somehow being celebrated as heroes. Like, well, what led to this moment? And these are all the things that we reveal in the film.
Yeah, does it feel like it's some level of just contrarianism? I mean, because you go through even the fact that women's groups were not responding to denounce the rape of women in these attacks. I mean, you're a student. I don't know. Maybe you're just thinking I'm going to take the other side. I can't come up with an actual answer as to why this is happening. But what is it? Is it the fundamentals to these ancient hatreds? What is it?
I think it's a combination. I think it's really the perfect storm. I think there's this deep-seated ideology that's coming out of progressive circles that paints everything this binary, the oppressor oppressed, right? And the oppressor is Israel. The oppressor are Jews, the white colonialists, even though Jews are arguably not white in America, they are often white passing. That's one of the sort of myths we try to debunk in the film also, that Jews, especially if you go to Israel, most people are definitely not white passing. They are brown or even black. You know, here in America, I think people's perceptions of what a Jewish person looks like, you know, is a white passing Jew. But it's this oppressor oppressed binary that creates this dynamic where there's, you know, if you were considered to be an oppressor, which is what, you know, a Jew is considered in America, or certainly the state of Israel, then there's no way that you can be discriminated against. And I think this ideology has been baked into academia, into the social sciences, into the humanities, into the Middle East studies programs for decades now. And that's part of the problem. And I will argue that I think there's a lot of young people who think they're on the right side of this issue. They're the social justice warriors. They think they're doing the right thing. They think they're, you know, looking out for the oppressed. And by doing that, they're standing up to, you know, what they perceive to be as this oppressor, which, you know, is the state of Israel vis-a-vis Jew. The problem is that Zionism has been hijacked, right? The word Zionist has become this pejorative, this dirty word, which, by the way, is not a new thing. It goes back decades to the Soviet Union with Zionism is racism. But when you're seeing signs like Zionist not allowed, and we see a scene at the UC Santa Barbara with the president of the student body, this woman, Tessa Vexler, a young woman holding up a sign that's posted at the Multicultural Center, which is, you know, beyond ironic. And it says Zionist not allowed. That means Jew not allowed. And I think we need to understand what we're talking about here. When you say no Zionist, you mean no Jew. And so this idea of the oppressor oppressed and this ideology that's really been baked into our culture that was fringe, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, has really jumped the lab and has become much more mainstream. And what's happened is that anti-Semitism, which is the oldest hatred, evolves over time. And the latest version of that is this fanatical, obsessive anti-Zionism, this feeling that Israel is a pariah state, that they're exceptionalized as the, you know, Jew among nations, like the worst country out there. We don't look at Iran. We don't look at Sudan. We don't look at China. We don't look at any other nation the way that we look at Israel. And by exceptionalizing Israel, that becomes anti-Semitism. We're not talking about criticizing policies or criticizing the government or criticizing Bibi Netanyahu. We're talking about delegitimizing the state of Israel. That becomes anti-Semitism. That's where you're crossing the line.
Yes. And it is very suspicious that it seems to happen all the time, because I agree with you that a lot of this stuff is framed in this oppressor, oppressive or oppressor sort of situation. But like, they don't look at any of the other countries. It's always Israel. This is the only one they can ever find any oppression. And if I'm going to be the most charitable I can possibly be here, college students aren't always on top of the right and wrong. You're young, you might be an idiot. And a lot of people wind up years later saying, gosh, I can't believe what I believed in college, right? Like, that's pretty common. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could explain it, but how do you explain it when it comes to these institutions? How do you explain it when it comes to the media? The way that they have handled these incidents and the aftermath in particular was shocking even to me, who comes to this with a hefty scoop of skepticism.
You know, I really think it's the perfect storm. And one of the things we try to unpack in the film is it's bias coming from the media, bias coming from NGOs like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, the United Nations, UN Women, the silence that we saw from the world. This, again, this sort of deep-seated, almost fanatical, obsessive feeling towards Israel, again, as a sort of exceptional nation that the world holds to a different standard than any other country. And when you have decades of the media calling Israel an apartheid state, and you have decades of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch calling Israel an apartheid state, I mean, nothing is worse than being called an apartheid state, right? That is like being called racist and an apartheid. That is, you know, the sort of the top tier of evil. And when we look at sort of, you know, the civilized world. And I think that is really what we're dealing with here. And listen, you know, Israel, you know, everyone I think can agree that they don't do a great job at their own PR. They've never worried about it. They're in a very unfriendly neighborhood, and people would argue, you know, they've got bigger fish to fry. There's sort of an existential issues that they face every single day when they're being targeted by their surrounding neighbors, particularly Iran. But what we're seeing now is a manifestation of years in the making of that sort of pounding away at Israel as this oppressor, as a colonial regime, as a illegitimate country, and as an apartheid state. And it's sort of, you know, it's this Venn diagram. So you have people who, you know, who are journalists now at the New York Times and the Washington Post and the NPR and sort of all the mainstream you know, publications and institutions. And they've come through these universities where they have been also taught this oppressor-oppressed binary. And it's also been sort of pounded into them that Israel is a colonial, you know, illegitimate country. Not, listen, not everyone feels that way. I'm speaking in, you know, general terms. But what we saw became the perfect storm after October 7th. It was like the world was waiting to go. It was as if Israel had it coming. And I think that silence from the world, the silence from Hollywood, the silence from social justice organizations and UN Women, all of that led me to making this film. And, you know, I think a lot of people were really stunned by the level of hate that seemed to explode overnight. But I would argue it had been bubbling up for a long time. And we just saw, you know, it erupt on October 8th. And like, let me also explain, this is not in this film, and these issues are not about the Jews and the Jewish community or the state of Israel. We are talking about democracy in the West versus Islamic jihadism and extremism. That is what this is about. It is something much bigger than just the Jewish community and anti-Semitism.
It's very, very true. And I will say a lot of the topics we talk about on a day-to-day basis, they can be difficult. You go back and forth. This one really should be easy. This one is really, really obvious that you don't stand on the side of Hamas. This should not be difficult. And you do a great job, Wendy, going through not only that it did happen, but how it happened in the new documentary. It's called October 8. It is available to rent right now. Be sure to check it out wherever you can. It's worth your time. And, you know, we can't just let this slide. This is this is really a human moment that we really need to understand who we are and what we're backing and what we're allowing to slide. It's really unspeakable. Wendy, thanks so much for doing this documentary and drawing attention to it.
Thank you so much for having me, Stu. And yes, it is available to rent on Amazon and Apple TV and all of the platforms where you can rent.
Please
films.
Do. Thanks so much,
Thank
Wendy.
You so much.
Well, there is a new pope. Yeah. I frankly just don't follow the interdynamics all that closely when it comes to this stuff. Like, I don't know all the names. I don't know who's who. It was big news, though. And I mean, and the sort of like pageantry of it all is still fascinating. Of course, you have the kind of the white smoke comes up. Everyone's freaking out. I mean, CNN was amazing. They had incredible insight and analysis. One of them at one point said it's either going to be one of the favorites or it could be a long shot. I hadn't really thought of that, but it came out with, apparently we got the first American pope. That's the big headline. Cardinal Robert Prevost, Pope Leo XIV is going to be known as. I did, when I first heard, hey, it's going to be an American pope, I did think, did Jeffy actually pull this off? Because he's been trying to run for pope for as long as I've known him. And every single opening he's tried to become pope, never was able to pull it off. They did at one point say it was taking too long, and they said apparently one of the previous popes was a larger person and it took a while because they had to like sew multiple pope uniforms together. And I was like, did Jeffy get this? But no, he did not, unfortunately. I will say, you know, I have many conservative Catholic friends, maybe you could call them traditionalists. They don't seem excited about this particular pick. In fact, they were like, please let it be the guy from Africa, not the guy from America. And all these racists who apparently wanted the black pope from Africa instead of the white pope from Chicago. But we got the white pope from Chicago, and everybody seems to be saying this is a continuation of Pope Francis, like very, very similar policies. There's been some social media activity. We now have popes that have Twitter accounts, which is amazing, and some criticism of people like J.D. Vance, who is, of course, you know, a practicing Catholic himself and cares very much about who I'm sure the next pope is. Imagine that, like, imagine being in that position where the pope has tweeting, like, kind of like trashing your viewpoints on Twitter. That's the world we live in now. So anyway, you know, we got a new pope. We'll get into that, I guess, as we, maybe we'll talk to somebody who knows a little bit more about this at some point to kind of get a, you know, because you're talking about over a billion people in the Catholic Church. It's obviously a very big deal, even if you're not Catholic. But that's where we are. The first American pope ever, and unfortunately not named Jeff Fisher. Somehow everyone with a smartphone thinks they're their real estate expert now because they've watched like three episodes of a home flipping show. That's the way it works. Realestateagentsitrust.com instead connects you with people who've done more than watch house flipping shows, people who understand the market, not just people who get their license when, you know, they needed a side hustle. These are agents who know which neighborhoods are undervalued, which upgrades actually matter to buyers, how to negotiate when every dollar counts. They've seen all the tricks and they know all the traps, while those part-timers are still figuring out how to work the lockbox. The housing market doesn't care about your feelings or your budget. It is a ruthless game where amateurs get crushed. Honestly, it happens all the time. And having a top-tier agent means the difference between getting maybe a great deal and becoming a cautionary tale at dinner parties for the next decade. Go to realestateagentsitrust.com, realestateagentsitrust.com. They've got this sorted out for you. The market is unpredictable, but working with a great agent doesn't have to be. It's realestateagentsitrust.com, a free service to you, realestateagentsitrust.com. All right, so a couple of interesting things. Joe Biden's out. He's out of the, they've let him out of the basement. He's out there talking again. It's, of course, working out as well as you might expect. Biden telling The View that Trump has had the worst 100 days of any president. I assume he ended that with "except me." I don't even know how he could do anything other than that. But he also said that he thought Kamala Harris lost just because she's a black woman, which is a really innovative analysis from a liberal. Like, that's shocking that they would go that direction. They would blame it on gender and skin color. Who would have seen it coming? Also, he said he could have won, which, again, the follow up never seems to come. Why did you drop out then? Why? Why didn't you just stay in? I will never understand it. Like, it's fascinating because while everyone around him quite clearly thought he was going to lose and correctly knows, and I think to be fair to Kamala Harris, he would have probably lost by more than she did. But still, it's like, if he doesn't believe that, why would he drop out? It's just absolutely amazing. He, by the way, still denies he has any mental issues. He's totally fine. Totally fine. So that's good. By the way, to give you some evidence of how his 100-day periods in his presidency went and how his mental issues were working, remember the Gaza pier. This is one of my favorite stories, honestly. Like I was telling you yesterday about the disaster with the California rail system. The Gaza pier is one of my favorite stories. This is the one where they're like, well, what if we just put a floating pier in and then we could give them all the relief that they need, you know, for all the Hamas members who are over there murdering Jews a couple of weeks ago. Wouldn't it be great if we gave a pier and we just gave them lots of free food? Well, that was a great idea from the start. They said it was going to cost this tiny amount. Of course, it went up, 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 and up. It was estimated to cost $320 million. It delivered almost no aid. The high winds and rough seas soon tore the pier apart, costing $22 million. Now, hidden in a new report is another line of what else happened, because apparently the operation damaged 27 watercraft and pieces of equipment. That required repair and maintenance, and that was another $31 million we're just finding out about. Just absolutely incredible, and such a great picture of the Biden presidency as a whole. Like, a terrible idea at the start, something that couldn't ever really possibly ever work anyway. It failed miserably. The media held his water, denied it most of the time until it basically broke apart in pieces in front of our eyes. And then we find out later it was much, much worse than we ever thought. That's the Biden presidency in a nutshell for you. And that's what we saw with the Gaza pier. Mother's Day is approaching. It's actually like 3 days away, so it's much more than approaching. And you've probably already blown the gift opportunities at this point. A lot of the gift options don't measure up. And this year, you can kind of skip the flowers and the last minute shopping and instead give something truly meaningful, a ticket to Share the Arrows with Ali Beth Stuckey, of course, of Blaze Media. She's going to be in Allen, Texas, October 11th. It's a great event. After all the work, you know, the lady in your life does, this is the chance for her to be renewed and refreshed. And this is an event that has an exceptional lineup as well of speakers and performers. It's the perfect gift that requires no shipping and no wrapping. I am appealing to guys with that one. Like, you don't have to just sign up. It's it'll keep it easy. Make a quick, thoughtful decision that shows genuine appreciation for everything she does. She'll love this event. It's a great experience. It will strengthen her faith, connect her with a community of like-minded women. Tickets will sell quickly for this event, so secure yours now. It's sharetheArrows.com. It's sharetheArrows.com. My wife went to this last year and really enjoyed herself, went with a bunch of her friends, and it was a great event. It's a great Mother's Day gift as well. SharetheArrows.com. It's sharetheArrows.com.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil. Unser Bestes.